Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Edmund.
Woo! We did it! Anyway, we are here to talk, that's right, Criminal Minds. In Season 6, or as I call it, the long wait for Rachel Nichols to show up, which happens so much later in the season than I thought it did.
We have to wait till number 10, I think.
We're going to do 3 episodes before she even gets here. The defining element of the season is them swapping out JJ for Rachel Nichols. And she doesn't even show up for 9 episodes.
Yeah, she shows up in 10.
That's crazy. All right, but you know what? We'll get there. Right now, we're talking other episodes of the show. So, start me up with...
Compromising Positions.
Oh,
when 2 Akron, Ohio couples are killed after being forced to have sex, the BAU sets out to track down a killer attempting to compensate for his own impotence. Meanwhile, Garcia volunteers to take over the still vacant role of communication liaison.
Yeah, this is a... So, first off, the episode exists only to shame people with open marriages and swingers, so like it's really hardcore into shaming people for doing that is the episode. It's written by people who have a real bone to pick with swingers, because it's not like this is just a community and now they're being preyed on. It's literally, there's a lot of judgment going this way in this episode.
Yeah, well, it took me, actually it reminded me of, there was an old episode of The Coroner in Vancouver, the Canadian one.
Oh, Da Vinci's Inquest.
That's it. Da Vinci's Inquest, right? There was an episode they did with swingers. In that episode, let me see. It's a stepfather who gets killed. The son kills the stepfather because the son found all of these compromising photographs of his mother, and his mother stupidly said to him, right? Said to her son, my husband is like, you know, your stepdad is forcing me to do this.
Okay.
Right. But it's so funny though. I mean, it is so different from this episode, because I mean, a couple of the things, like when the detectives go in and they see this one house where everybody just tends to go to.
Yeah.
And they're talking to different couples because they're trying to figure out who killed this man. So they're talking to these different couples, and there's this one couple, and it was the guy, of course, who persuaded his wife that this would be great.
Yeah.
Right. And then it turns out he's not very happy with it at all, but she took to the new lifestyle. And it was just funny watching this couple, right? As they're being interviewed. I mean, they had nothing to do with it. It was just, so they handled it quite differently. And it was years before this, because Da Vinci's Inquest was the 90s, I think.
Oh yeah, mid to late 90s, and then he became mayor. That's actually one of my favorite stories ever. That the guy, I mean, it was based on a real life medical examiner in the city of Vancouver, and he, of course, you know, consulted on the show and talked about real cases and blah 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 blah. And so while the show was running, he became mayor of Vancouver.
so they
had to change the show, so he was mayor now.
So he became mayor.
He ran for mayor, and of course, became mayor.
We love Nicholas Campbell. Because
Nicholas Campbell's always the best.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's Diamonds.
A really good show. If you ever want to watch something very interesting, Da Vinci's Inquest is the show for you. There's a lot of really good episodes of Da Vinci's Inquest because it's him and it's Donnelly Rhodes and it's Ian Tracy.
And if you want to watch the Canadian version of all of those couples shows, you can go watch Diamonds. The first starring role he had.
Yeah. Oh, he's so fantastic in Diamonds. The wonderful detective team show. Just such a wonderful detective show.
Or it's Diamond and Diamond or Diamond.
Diamond. No, it's called Diamonds. Anyway.
Yeah, it was called Diamonds instead of Simon and Simon.
No,
there was the one with Robert Wagner Susan, what's her face?
Ooh.
It's an old, old show.
Robert Wagner. Heart to Heart.
heart to heart, right? So it was sort of the Canadian version.
Yeah, but that kind of feel.
Without money. Without yes, money. Except right? They Canadians rich. Don't have aren't rich.
It's a really good show, though. And I mean, seriously, Nicholas Campbell's great. And Ian Tracy would go to star in Intelligence, which only lasted 2 seasons, but was one of the best TV shows that CBC ever did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's honestly fantastic.
Okay, so, yeah, let's get back to compromising positions.
I know we have to. We're just not psyched to.
We're telling people all about these wonderful Canadian shows they should track down and watch.
I know, it's terrible.
Probably show up on the CBC. You can do CBC Gem if you want. If you want to watch old CBC shows. And
but anywho.
Shows. Anywho, getting back to compromising positions. Okay, so.
I know, but anyway, so people, and it's funny because I'm sure I made a joke about this in the episode, in my review. But it's like, at the first end, it's like, they got Emily saying, wow, kill just another couple a week later. That's not much of a cooling off period. And I'm like, how do you know what the term cooling off period is? Every single killer you chase kills one person, at least one person every single day. Like, the concept of a cooling off period does not exist to you people.
Well, yeah, no, but they have to say it. It's I think, you know, in the show notes, yeah. There's a list of words that they have to mention. And
every
cooling
week.
Off period is one of them, you know. Somebody's got to say something about a cooling off period, right?
Yeah, it's like, well, then they'll sound like professionals. I'm like, yeah, but
no,
that's
no,
not
because
true.
then they can bring up that they're afraid it's going to turn into a spree, which, of course, in this case, it does.
Well, that's only because every single week it does turn into a spree. It never doesn't turn into a spree.
We're going to have to start treating this almost like a comedy because I just can't. I do not know when I'm going to recover from the wonder that was the inside.
Oh, I know.
To take this friggin' show seriously.
Yeah, it's hard to take this seriously after you've seen the inside. You're absolutely
okay,
right.
Okay. And it's season 6, so we're right.
It's season 6. We're at the precipice. Well, we're on the downward slope is what's
yes,
going on
yes,
here.
Yes. And this episode, so he kills, and then
he kills his family, and then we got this ridiculous. Okay, so first off, I just want to say that the people who wrote this episode treat the concept of being an alpha male as if it is a diagnosable condition, rather than a incredibly shallow social construct.
Well, just remember that in the last episode that we're going to deal with this week.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not the last episode. Oh, no. In episode 7, we're going to get back to alpha males
okay.
again.
All right. So don't spoil it for me. But because I have no memory of that episode. But anyway, it's just interesting because they're full on. The way they talk about the concept of being an alpha male, they act like all of the characters are acting and talking about it like it is a diagnosable condition that has wonderfully, obviously recognizable traits. I'm like, no, it's an incredibly shallow diagnosis that is pop psychology at its worst.
Well, it's toxic masculinity.
Oh, no, it is. I mean, the whole concept of, you're absolutely right, that the whole concept of toxic masculinity, right, is inexorably connected with the concept of the alpha male.
Okay, but what you're doing, what this episode is doing, is not treating it like it's a diagnosable condition. They're treating it like it is a genetic.
Oh, yes, like it's a genetic state. Obviously, he's an alpha male, and he recognizes other, and he wants to react to other alpha male. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Are you out of your mind?
No, it's the way they talk about the concept of alpha maleness in this is ridiculous and belongs more on a like an internet message board than coming out of the mouths of psychologists. Like,
and
he saw the other men being more alpha than he is, and it made him want to kill them. I'm like, Jesus Christ, is this an incel message board? Yes or no? Because everything you're saying, Dr. Reed, sounds like it is being pulled from an incel message board.
Oh God, it was just such, you know.
It's a terrible episode.
The funny thing is that there are so many things they could have left out, and still, like this. Because it's not the alpha males. He set out to kill all of these men because one of them made his wife pregnant.
Yes.
That's why he's killed them.
Oh, I know.
Because his wife was really, really stupid.
Yes.
And thought, well, he still wants a child, so
I'll go out
I'm
and
going
I'll...
to get pregnant. Yeah. Get pregnant, and she deludes herself into
yeah, except thinking that he can believe that. Yeah.
And he was fine with it until she started to show.
Yep.
And that's the bottom line. It has nothing to do with being an alpha male.
Oh, of course.
Nothing. Not. And he was such a creep.
I know.
Right from the beginning, he was looking, you know, I mean, he only gets husbands. That's why he knew he didn't know Emily, because he only used to get
pairs,
husbands for
he
his
focuses
wife.
On negotiating with the husbands for their, for sleeping sex. With their wives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like it is a trade-off between men who control women. And that's how he immediately knows that Emily must be lying when she goes to pretend to be one of the swingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's weird because she could have known that had they just interviewed more about how the swinger parties operated involving him. But they don't bother doing that.
No, why would they?
No.
They don't like these people, and they don't want to talk to these people because they're scum of the earth.
I know. It's just the disrespect they show to these people. It's kind of shocking. And I want to point out that I'm not saying they get those 8 men killed, but I feel like there's a good chance that people in these swinger communities know one another, and they sure as hell don't ask for the phone numbers of any other regular parties that he might have gone to, so they can call them and warn them about the mass murderer targeting swingers. Mm-hmm. They sure as hell don't do that, so maybe they do get those people killed? Because it's the middle of the afternoon when they go talk to the swingers in their house, right? The people who run the house. And then it's late that night that he goes and kills everybody. So I feel like there was a chance to warn the swinger community.
Well, they should have. Yeah. They should have just.
But they don't.
I mean, and the girl should never have let him in without his wife.
Well, yeah, that's terrible.
But
he just honestly, he would have just shot her and pushed his way. It's like, it's not like it's her fault.
I know.
He would have just started shooting people from the doorway.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then you have this, like, the idea that, the ridiculous that they figure out he's a locksmith, because when he was on a rampage going through the house, he instinctively, instead of kicking the door open, picked the lock. Only a locksmith would do that because he did it out of reflex. And I'm like, you don't reflexively pick locks. Picking locks is an ordeal. You have to take out your lock picking kit. You have to open up your lock picking kit. You have to find the right lock picks for the door. You have to sit there for like a minute and a half kneeling in front of a door trying to pick it while you know the cops are on the way.
And you've got a gun, so you could just shoot the door.
You got 2 guns. You could just shoot up the door.
it's such a dumb
episode.
You know?
Oh, God. It really is. It's just a stupid episode in every way.
And the writer
like one of those episodes where you're like, is there anything redeeming about this episode?
But this is what is going to bring you to the downfall of the show, because this is one of the guys that is early on. I think he started writing last season,
right,
but it's now going to continue being a staple on the show.
On the show, right. Turning in terrible scripts.
Janine Sherman Barwaz is also there. Like, you can just see why things are going to go wrong when you look at episodes of the people who are consistently writing. Erica writes a hell of a lot of episodes in this show.
Yep.
I think this may be the last season. I don't know. This may be the last season Simon Mirren writes for it, but.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And then he goes off and then he comes back as a director. So.
Huh. I mean, anyway. I think one of these this week is directed by Guy Norman Bee. I thought
it was this one.
It was this one. Wow. Real step down, Guy. Although, again, you're not in charge of the scripts. You're only in charge in how you present it. And failure there, too, because this episode contains one of the things I've most made fun of in the history of the episode, which is they walk up to the house of the swingers, and they're like, oh, great, Jehovah's Witnesses. Which is a perfectly appropriate thing to say if you see an FBI agent at your door, because an FBI agent at your door will be standing there in a charcoal black suit and a white shirt and a charcoal black tie.
Wait a sec. But that's not Jehovah's Witnesses. Those are Mormons.
Yes, you're right. She,
she should have said Mormons.
You're right. She should have said Mormons. I think they just didn't want to risk offending Mormons. No one risks. It's true. Like, no one is afraid of offending Jehovah's Witnesses, I'm sorry to say, but people are a little worried about offending Mormons.
Yeah, no.
Sometimes Mormons blow things up, is all I'm saying. I'm specifically referencing an episode of Criminal Minds. Do you know which one? But anyway.
No. Well, this may be Guy Norman Bee's last episode. Maybe he got kind of fed up. Maybe he was on a break and he agreed to do this episode. Who knows?
Because he was off doing Supernatural at this point, right?
Yeah, he's doing Supernatural. He's doing a bunch of other things, and most everything else he does
is in Vancouver. Yeah. So who knows? You're right. It's one of those situations where it's possible they lost a director at the last minute and they called the guy they knew and they like and they knew could do the job. Like, that kind of stuff happens all the time.
Yeah, and maybe things had already gotten so bad on the set, and this is only episode 4, so bad on the set that he just said, oh, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore.
All right, so so here's what's interesting about it, though, right? It's like, it's just so funny because that is 100% a line of dialogue you would say if an FBI agent showed up at your door. Like, that is completely believable as a response to have that, oh, people in the black suits. But who shows up at your door is a woman with, like, her hair in no way done up, just hanging down around her shoulders, wearing, like, a red top and a black suit jacket, and a man in t-shirt and jeans. No one looks at those two people and says, oh, this must be Jehovah's Witnesses, or this must be Mormons. Like, no one would react to that visual in the way the character does.
Now, just a minute.
Please.
Remember, Prince was a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
And he used to go door to door.
Oh, I'm sure, but I'm sure he also dressed in a nice suit. When he didn't go door to door dressed like Prince.
I'm sorry.
He put on a suit.
I just couldn't resist.
No, it's just such a dumb moment in this episode because it's like you're writing this as if it's about the FBI, not about the ridiculous characters of Criminal Minds. Like, there's a moment where they arrive in town and the guy's like, hi, I was specifically told by Penelope Garcia that I'm supposed to call you Dr. Reed. And I'm like, wow, again. Seems kind of pathetic there, but more importantly...
Well, you insist I call myself Dr. Redmond.
As a satirical comment on this exact thing in the show.
I know. But you know what's so funny? No, but this is why they had to say Jehovah's Witness. Because they didn't look like FBI agents.
Well, no, but the thing is, Jehovah's Witnesses and FBI agents look identical. That's the joke. The joke is that Jehovah's Witnesses and FBI agents, if one turned up at the door, you wouldn't know which it was.
But it's not a joke, because only if you have two men showing up in black suits and white ties.
That's my point. At the script stage, I'm sure... No. What I'm saying is, I guarantee that their FBI consultant, Jim Clemente, had told them stories about them showing up at somebody's door and them opening the door and seeing two guys in suits and saying, oh, great, the Mormons are here, the Jehovah's Witnesses are here. So Jim Clemente told them that story and they said, oh, we'd better put that in an episode. That's hilarious. So they just put it in the episode without thinking about the fact that these people don't dress like professionals.
No, not these two. If Aaron had shown up with Joe.
If Aaron had shown up, sure. Yeah.
Maybe.
Then they absolutely,
but he's too
you could
old.
Say that.
He's too old to be a Mormon.
Yeah, to be a guy doing missionary work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Missionary work is going to be the work. Well, I mean, they're all too old to be the ones doing missionary work. That's like the lowest level stuff.
Well, no, not for Jehovah's Witnesses. My Jehovah's Witness, I have Jehovah's Witnesses who come pretty standard and really? They're all retired.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, because
I've only ever seen young Jehovah's Witnesses dropping by doors.
Oh, every now and then I see a young one who comes in with the older one to get some practice. But I think, like, I have, over the years that I've been back in Sault Ste. Marie, I have gotten a relationship with this one woman, right?
Yeah.
And so she likes to come just, I think, to find out how things are going and how I'm doing.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, yeah. We have a great conversation usually. So,
see, that's wonderful to hear.
So I know all about her stuff and like her physical ailments and children and things like that. And I know she knows all about mine.
Well, no. And so what I find fascinating here is this is clearly a story they were told by like Jim Clemente.
Yeah.
And then they just put it in the episode without even thinking for a moment that it couldn't happen in their world because their characters don't dress like FBI agents. Mm-mm. Like that is obviously what's happening here. And it's just how incredibly sloppy the show is that no one would have noticed or cared that the joke made no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense,
yeah,
right?
No, it doesn't make any
sense.
Like
you're just going, you look at it and go, no, how could you mistake those two?
These two for Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses. There's just no way.
There's no way.
But yeah, okay, one other thing about this episode before we move on. First off, it's a god-awful episode. If anyone has told you anything about alphas or alpha males or blah, 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 basically what's happening is a marketing agency is trying to sell you something.
Yeah. Like
that is the only way any person has ever talked about alpha without making fun of it, is a marketing company is trying to sell you a hair product. That's it.
or that spray stuff.
Or Axe body spray, exactly.
Oh,
yes.
God, and that stuff smells.
The most disgusting stuff in the world.
It was after that, after Axe came out, that the university started putting up these great big huge signs about you couldn't wear
perfumes,
anything
yeah.
that smells. Well, yeah, because you can't call it perfume if men are wearing it.
I know, right?
Right?
No,
yeah,
it's a body
you know,
spray.
Men don't wear perfume.
And well, no, but it's like that's part of the toxic masculinity is that don't even call it perfume. Like, you're wearing perfume. It's fine if you want to smell. You should, in a specific way, like, we accept that in culture. You probably shouldn't want to smell like Axe body spray, but, you know, there you go.
Well, anyway, it was the chemical. It was funny because we have a couple of people at the university.
With real allergies?
Full time, like, with serious issues with.
And the Axe stuff is so powerful that they're more likely to react badly to it than they are to most women's perfumes.
Oh, well, no, things like opium, like there's a bunch of women's things too, that are so severe
right.
that, you know, so what you do is you just say, nobody gets to wear smelly stuff.
Yeah. Of any kind. It's just, you got to draw the line, but I just like that. It's only after Axe body spray became a thing that they decided they needed to start doing that.
Well, you know, there were always signs, but basically It was after the Axe body spray, and they wanted to blame it on a particular cultural group, but it wasn't.
Oh, no.
It was, you know, it was like of men who
They
were all wearing all of this alpha male, this Axe body, you know, blah, blah, blah. No. Go back to your no smell deodorant.
Yeah. It's
you know,
really...
and hospitals and everything else, but even at the university. And actually, they have it at my... even at the public school, like where I'm doing ESL now, there are signs over all over it too.
Yeah, just no sense.
No sense at all. I think Axe body spray was really did push the limit, and
yeah,
that was
it. Did
right,
and they had to draw the line somewhere, and they drew it at Axe body spray.
Yeah, without saying it.
So it's an interesting thing, though, and I think it's worth mentioning, right? That within this episode, that we haven't mentioned the one major thing that happens this episode. Which is, and this is kind of interesting, is they have this thing where they're going to try to explain what they're going to do without JJ, because they have no intention of... I mean, in real life, they would have just hired a new media liaison.
Yeah.
Like, because, I mean, they've already done that on the show when she went off and had a kid. They just hired another one. There is nothing unique about the job she does or her performance in it. And so we get this weird moment that will then, like, underline everything that happens for the next while on the show. Garcia's like, I can do her job. I'm like, you definitely can't do her job. Garcia, we love you. You're terrible with people. Like, you get really nervous with people. And more importantly, and this is what she seems to forget, you already have a job.
Yeah.
Your job is to sit at a computer and do all of their tech stuff. If you're out there in the field talking to the media and talking to grieving families, who's doing the computer stuff? And she's like, well, I'll get Kevin to do it. I'm like, but then Kevin doesn't do it for the rest of the episode, and we still see her sitting at the local computer trying to do both. I'm like, if Kevin actually did it, it would be fine. But they don't, she's unwilling to just let Kevin do her real job while she tries out the JJ role. It's very strange, because she tries to do both and has a mini breakdown because, you know, she's dropping stuff and she's missing stuff because she's trying to do both jobs. But it's like, they're two very different jobs, and they're both full-time jobs.
And they
can't do both. And the thing is, it's like, JJ was, and she chides herself and is angry at herself because JJ was able to do all of this. And I'm like, no, she wasn't. She did one job.
Yeah.
She wasn't juggling multiple things. She was just focused on being a liaison to the media and talking with the family members. That's all she did. She didn't also make herself responsible for every single piece of governmental information I needed to find out. It's like, you can't be expected to do two jobs. And it's weird because this episode is the only time they mention that they don't have a JJ anymore. Like, this is it.
Yep.
And it's like, they expect it. It's like, you know, just stay in your lane, Garcia. And then she does. And then for the rest of the show, they don't have a media liaison or someone to talk to the families of victims. And the show just never mentions that that's even a thing ever again. And it's like, it's so weird to say goodbye to an entire job on the team. But that's what they do when JJ leaves, to the point that when JJ comes back, she's not doing that job anymore. Now she's just another generic profiler. It's like they have fallen so away. By the time she comes back, they have fallen so away from what this job is supposed to be that they don't even pretend that, like, JJ's job is something that needs doing. And that's weird. Like, that's really weird.
No, it's one of the things that is a problem for the show, because what happens is, one of the things that you always had in the show was you could deal with the family things, right? And
the consequences of this kind of violence.
The consequences of this violence. And you had it, you had JJ, she was this this character that could kind of pull in. So in other words, she
was kind, she was human, she reached out to people, like,
and she could handle the media, and she was tough, and and the rest of it. And as you say, and as we always say, she had the only stable marriage relationship in the group. Right? With
literally
children.
The only stable relationship in the entire show.
Yeah. But the thing is that I am sure that it came down from CBS. Well, you've got to cut something. And so everybody says this is expendable. So they spend the next 9 years proving that, guess what? JJ wasn't expendable.
No.
That you can't have the FBI, this team, without someone to handle communications, because you don't have then the handling communications properly. You don't have any of it being handled properly.
It essentially, and it's that weird to say, if you cut JJ and her role on the team, you lose both, like, this very human element of the show, and you also make it a lot less believable, because the media's involvement in an obsession with this kind of cases has always been in the background of this show up until this point.
Yeah.
So it's like, by cutting JJ's role, you both make the show less believable.
Yeah.
And you make the show less human.
Yeah.
Right? And it's fascinating.
Well, and then it starts to become generic. Like, I don't think that they, I don't know that they ever thought just how important that was. And I don't think they ever thought that. Because
no, I guarantee you're right. They didn't.
No, they never thought that. And remember, because they don't think about their show as a whole.
And I think that's what makes the Rachel Nichols thing so fascinating. Because when Rachel Nichols leaves and JJ comes back, they don't go back to JJ doing her job. Well, essentially, no, she starts doing Rachel Nichols's job, and it's as if they've, I mean, other than literally, if you watch the after JJ comes back, and I'm going to test this when we watch it here, but I suspect that it's like, because she's not working with the media anymore, because she's not working with the family anymore, it's almost as if they just kept writing the Rachel Nichols character, but gave the lines to JJ.
Well, I don't know. Well, we'll have to test that, because she maybe have been brought back to replace Emily Prentice.
Kind of. But because
Emily
maybe...
Prentice gets fired.
Yeah,
she
does.
After Rachel Nichols gets fired.
I know, right? No, at the same time.
Emily Prentice, yeah. Yeah. So they both get fired,
right? It's the same episode, yeah. Because she gets killed off.
They get the
cheaper. And then Rachel Nichols leaves. And then she comes back for one season.
Who does?
Emily. She gets killed off, and then she comes back for a season. It's
yes.
6 and 7 are very weird seasons. Like, the show really does flatten out after season 7, but 6 and 7 are very weird seasons, which is what we're going to go through. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. We're going to talk about it, but I think the greatest, it's weird that I can put that one of the greatest losses for the show is A, the loss of JJ, and B, the fact that when JJ comes back, they don't understand that the show was just, it's not just that the show was missing this actor, it's that the show was missing this role, and when she comes back no longer in that role, the show doesn't get fixed.
No, the show doesn't get fixed. It doesn't fix
just because the actor came back.
Yeah. You know? It's the role that she played
on the team.
And if you had put somebody else in that role and made her a profiler, it probably would have worked. But they only brought back one person.
Yeah.
Anyway, never mind. Let's just
we'll get there. You know what? We'll get there. It's just it's weird because you get these scenes of, you know, you get these scenes of her talking to the media. Of like Penelope talking to the media and not doing
and
a good job and beating herself up. And it doesn't work at all.
And this is what we call, this is the beginning of the clusterfuck that Criminal Minds becomes.
Becomes, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to Safe Haven.
Please.
When two Midwest families are killed in their homes, the BAU attempts to track down a psychopathic adolescent with a desire to punish matriarchal figures. Meanwhile, Morgan receives an unexpected visit from a former acquaintance. Good God, acquaintance? Good God.
I know.
There are a million things that are wrong with this episode. So let's just start talking about the episode itself. And then we can scream about Morgan and what was her name?
I'm blanking on the daughter's name. But anyway, it's
anyway. Never
mind. Let's through the very stupid episode we're watching.
Okay, so you've got this. Well, except. I mean, my good God. I mean, it's very perfunctory.
Yeah.
So they've got the two Midwest families. I thought that, and I'm so glad that the mother that was smart enough to work with this kid survives.
Yep.
And all I can say in this episode is this kid did not have a frigging chance.
No, he didn't. No, that's clearly
no
the message of the episode.
Chance.
No.
This mother was so abhorrent that this child did not have a chance except to turn into some kind of a vile, evil murderer.
Yeah. Well, no, because, she turned him into one.
Yeah, because she tells him he murdered his brother or sister.
Yeah.
In the womb.
And she's always hated him for that. And it has been underlying their entire relationship. She's always been withdrawn from him. She has always been cold to him. And then when he's frigging 4 years old and she has another kid that she genuinely loves, of course he only got worse.
Well, it was terrible. Plus, you know, any doctor that says this, that's not how it works, but never mind. I don't even want to go. I mean, it's
like... the kid didn't have a chance.
You know what the funny thing is? This is sort of the Elvis Presley story where, you know, in some ways, except that both of them did survive initially.
Briefly,
I think his brother was born, but...
I think so, yes.
Died in birth.
Identical twin died in childbirth and the mother never forgave him.
Well, never got over it or whatever. Yeah. I don't know that the mother never forgave him, but she turned him into some kind of a... a husband surrogate. I mean, this is that's.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sickness in there.
There was a lot there, but he didn't. He turned into a singer.
That's true. He did not turn into a murderer.
He did not turn because the mother did love him.
Yeah, that's
in some in some bizarre way. Whereas here, this woman blames him because his twin died in utero.
Yeah.
Big deal. It happens. Doesn't happen often. You know, and nobody stopped this mother from, like, her mother didn't at some point step in.
Yeah.
Somebody didn't
say,
step
no,
in.
You're, the way you're treating this child is terrible and it's going to cause
problems.
Just
terrible. And then, of course, he just becomes, I mean, he just kills. He kills two couples and their children. He then kills the minister. Yeah. And
the
then
minister, anyone who shows him. What he
any
thinks
compassion.
Is fake kindness. Yeah.
Any compassion whatsoever, he doesn't believe, and he kills.
Yeah. And it's interesting because my big takeaway from the episode when I first watched, and I stand by this, is, like, as sad as this kid's life is, I fundamentally don't believe that that woman, you know, upon seeing him, seeing him not wearing a seatbelt, wouldn't have just driven into a tree killing him. Like, I know that he's a child, I know that she's a mother, but here's the thing. She's a mother, and he threatened to rape and murder her daughter. So, no. Like, she's going to drive that kid into a tree. Just putting that out there.
100%
she's going to drive that kid into a tree.
I'm not going to worry about that.
No, it's not a major point, but I'm like, there's no way this woman just placidly drives this guy all the way to murder somebody without at least trying to drive him into a tree and take him out. Because, no, her family, as far as she knows, her family is at risk and might die if she lets this kid live. And it's like, if you're telling me she's just going to try to talk him out of it, even when he's, you know, threatening to rape and murder her 6-year-old daughter. No, I don't believe that.
Anyway, she was so, it was, I don't even.
Yeah.
I give them that one in this episode. I'm just That's going, no, you know,
you,
she's,
you
she's, she, you know, I mean,
it's a stressful situation.
It's extraordinarily stressful. She's trying to manage things so she doesn't get killed.
Yeah.
And she's trying to, and she doesn't get killed. She gets stabbed, but she doesn't get killed. He doesn't spend any time stabbing her.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Because he's so close to his mother, he has to just rush back there. But my thing in that episode was, I think the idea that she wouldn't go to the police department felt very contrived. Like, you're already right there. This kid's in trouble, right? You know, this kid's in trouble.
No, yeah, that one I don't give them. Why doesn't she go in? Like, I could have seen she'd gone in and they say, well, he'd have to go in jail. And then she says, well, no, he can stay at my place tonight.
Overnight. Exactly.
Right. And actually, technically, if she'd gone in and then still brought him home, he wouldn't have killed her and the children because the police knew he was there.
Knew. Yeah. And it actually, the weird part is, if she had brought him in and had the conversation and said, well, I want him to, you know, so-and-so, right. Then I think it would have been interesting because you could have understood why he doesn't kill her and the kids.
Yep.
Why he just takes her on a road trip. Because it's like, okay, well, you know, my face is on record. My fake name is on record. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. It actually would have made more sense what happens in that scene.
However, then you see, we wouldn't get the listening to the answering machine.
Message. Oh, there you go.
You know, and it part of the plot. So, you know, that's
yeah, no,
get it.
I understand mechanically why there. It's just, the main plot of this episode isn't very interesting. And honestly, like, what do you call it? It's just, it almost seems like I understand why he wants to get home and murder his mother.
Yeah.
And murder his sister.
Sister. Yeah.
To, like, as payback. It's horrible, but I understand why the character wants that, right?
Yeah.
What I don't understand, like, they never really get me to the point of where he's just like, I'm going to murder whole families as well.
Yeah. And it doesn't get me to the point of why he even murdered the minister. There was no need
to. I don't get it. Like, if he was also, like, physically or sexually abused by a caregiver, okay, 100%, we get you there. But the psychological, like, hell that his mother put him through does not to me seem like if he, and I mean, I know we always go back to child abuse, but if in addition to that, he had looked for support from some guy, like a minister, like a family member of a neighbor, and the kid, that adult had seen this this kid in distress and molested him, then I would understand. Yeah. Why he's killing these families and look, killing anybody who reaches out to try to help him.
I mean, there's
and in fact, it would explain why he doesn't kill the mother and her kids, because the family doesn't have a father.
Yeah.
You know, if the fathers had also been targets, right? Yeah. If he's mad at his mother, but the father of a neighbor or a priest or something had molested him when he went looking outside of his family for help, boom, suddenly you've got, I know exactly who this kid is. I know exactly why he's doing what he's doing. But because they don't even hint at that, I honestly don't know why he's killing these families.
No, well, it's a perfunctory, perfunctory-ass episode. There's no depth to it. No. And then we end up with the idiocy around Morgan, and is it
the insulting half of the episode?
Yeah, the insulting half of the episode, and the most insulting part of this is how. I can remember when I saw this the first time. I called you and I screamed and hollered at the time. You probably don't remember, but because I came to the show later, right? After
I'd already written most of my reviews, yeah.
Well, no, a couple of years in, because you were writing the reviews, and I thought, well, if I'm going to read them, then I guess. If I'm going to read them and look for typos and all the rest of it, I might as well watch the show, right? And so, but I remember watching this episode and just getting so mad. First of all, how dare you leave a child in the foster care system after you promised his father, and then the sister essentially that you would watch, he promised he would watch out for her and take care of her. Care of her.
I know.
Not dump her in the foster care system, which you already know is hell because you're in the FBI.
And you're in the FBI specifically dealing with the aftermath of abused children. That's your day job, is dealing with the wreck left when kids get abused, and you put her into the foster care system.
You remember those foster care parents way back when with those two boys?
Yep.
Who killed, where Emily almost got a daughter?
Remember when Emily was going to frigging adopt a kid because her whole family was killed by victims of the foster care system?
You all know that the foster...
What it's like.
It's like, particularly, she's a cop's child. What do you mean? There isn't another cop family in the entire LAPD that isn't going to take this child in?
I know.
You put her in the friggin' foster care system?
Yep.
And then, of course, it turns out, I mean, she manages, she's a smart kid. She's self-reliant. She manages to steal the credit card of the foster mother. She gets on a plane. And then she shows up at the FBI office, you know, and Derek, we'll deal with this when I come back. You know, you should, you know, and I'm just like, yo, what, where is your sympathy? Where is your empathy? This was just disaster, because this is obviously
it's horrible
when they decided that they weren't going to follow this plot line down.
Yeah.
Right. And so what happens, of course, and then, you know, and then Garcia takes care of her while Derek's gone. I'm going, no, Derek, you should have just not gone.
Just don't go.
Right? And then you
stay and deal with this.
And deal with this problem. Deal with the little girl. You promised. She's been through horror with Tim Curry. You
literally as bad as anything that anyone can go through. She's been through that.
And that's only like 4 or 5 weeks ago. And then when Garcia phones the foster care family, they don't even know
that she's missing.
That she's
missing. Because they got six kids.
Yeah.
They didn't know the seventh one was missing. It's shocking.
Mm. It's just a god. It was just, I'm just going, I guess this is why we watch the social. We can just scream and holler about things like this.
I know.
But there there was no reason for this. She should have been. If they wanted to get rid of it, Morgan should get rid of that storyline. Morgan should have been talking to her and found out that she was living with another family. Yeah. Like there was another cop family that were close friends of her father.
Yep.
Right? Now
maybe Robert Davi's got kids. We don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Robert Davi, his partner, could have taken her in.
Yep.
You know, and then we find out she's got a mother.
I know. Who freaking abandoned the family.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, I just like, she wrote a letter to you in her journal every day. She never sent any of them. Mm. Because she's a narcissist.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're trying to say, this is someone, I don't think this woman ever wrote for the show again. Yeah. I think they're trying to say that she tried to contact her daughter and her ex-husband wouldn't even let her talk to him.
Which suggests there's something deeply wrong with this mother that we don't find out about.
Or there was something deeply wrong with him too. That he's not even, you know, allowing her, like, okay, so she's gone, but she could at least send Christmas presents. She couldn't send birthday presents. She couldn't send Christmas presents. She tried to keep up with her daughter, and he refused to allow her. His anger level at her was so great. And she, whatever she did, and who knows, I mean, it just seems like she got this great job and she couldn't cope with being a cop's wife and she couldn't cope with being a mother. And so she left.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's clearly the implication.
Yeah. You know, and I'm not saying she was a great mother, but if she was that bad, it was a good thing that she left.
Yeah.
Right? You know, in the sense she knew the limits. You got to know your limitations, and she knew her limitations, right?
Yeah, and it's like, if you can't be a parent to this kid, don't.
Yeah, but all of a sudden she's turned in, and you've got the journal that she's been writing all the time, and but that's just to give Derek. And they could have
an out. It's a, you know, it's out. To give him an out.
Yeah. And not only that, but as I said, having her adopted by another cop family would have been a much better out. A loving.
It would have been a stronger, more believable out. Yes.
Yeah. No. And then the end.
All right. Then, so before we get there, I just want to point out that before we talk about the end, right? Literally, we've talked before, we've hinted about this in the past couple of weeks, but I just can't stress enough. Like, truly, this was the moment to let Derek Morgan grow up. Yeah. Like, that's what this moment should have been, right? Absolutely, that's what this episode should have been, and it should have started an arc for his character where he adopts this girl and where he, you know, becomes the foster parent and where he starts moving it towards, like, fulfilling the stuff about his own father that he has to work through raising this daughter of a dead cop, right?
Yeah.
That's what should have happened with Derek Morgan, but that isn't what happened because this show doesn't know what it's doing, okay? That should have been this plot line, and it's kind of disgusting that it wasn't, and they copped out of it so terribly, along with the quote at the end of the episode!
I could not believe the quote at the end of the, like, sometimes their quotes are spot on, sometimes they're dead wrong,
but this was insulting.
The most insulting end to this episode and to this character arc.
Oh, I know, because we see him walking away, literally walking away from his responsibilities. Like, the character is literally walking in a direct line away from his responsibilities. And we go to Robert Frost. I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. You literally just broke your promise.
Yeah.
That's literally what I just watched you do, Derek. You broke your promise.
Okay, but his promise to the BAU is bigger than his promise to this little girl.
He can still keep his job. The man can afford a housekeeper.
He's got multiple houses.
He's got many houses. He's got money. He's doing fine.
Oh, give me a break. I tell you, if there's... You know, And then I kept watching the show, and it upsets me simply because of the subject matter and then the screwy writing and everything else. Right. So I just kept watching the show, but, and, you know, and you were doing the blog. So
absolutely.
So blah, 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 I get blah, why. Blah, you know, but at times, like, there were things like this where I would just, it would drive me crazy.
It makes you recoil with how terrible it is.
With how terrible it is in terms, and it's only when I started, when we started to talk about doing a blog, that I started to really look at this. And then you start to get into the different people and the, who's writing and who's the showrunner. And because I don't pay a lot of attention to that. Sometimes,
of course,
sometimes
normally.
You do, because some of the best shows have consistent showrunners.
Of course.
Right,
yeah.
Straight through because
as we found out about Tim Minear.
Well, yeah, but any of those shows, Josh Whedon is always Straczynski. Whoever, what's his name? Who did West Wing?
Aaron Sorkin. Yeah.
Who do
consistently good work. Yeah.
Well, they absolutely. Do consistent because they keep their eye on the ball with their show. They have a vision for their show. This show looked like it had a vision.
Yep.
All of a sudden, it's turning into God only knows what kind of crap. It's just that people are very attached to the different characters in this show.
Yeah.
That's
all it is.
Anything kept this going, it's that we like Hotch. We like, well, I don't like Morgan, the character. But we even have a fondness, love-hate relationship with the David Rossi character.
Oh, yeah.
We have the JJ character. We have...
We, like everybody else, have complicated relationships with a ton of these characters, just like all the other fans.
And
that, we're fans,
and so
too.
You get mad. You get mad when they screw up these characters' lives sometimes, too.
Well,
and
yeah,
what
we
they
do.
Don't allow.
And how it's so... And I think that's the worst part, is... And I think that's the biggest tragedy of this scene, this character, this episode, is... It was a chance to redeem and grow Derek Morgan, and they throw it away.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, Derek Morgan's never going to get better.
No.
And they're never going to acknowledge that there's anything wrong with him. Yeah. That's what kicks it for me, right?
Yeah, they're never going to acknowledge. I mean, he knows what it was like for him to have his cop father killed in front of him, and he's going to have nothing to do with this child again.
Yeah. And he's like,
and they're not going to address the fact that he hasn't dealt with the fact that his father.
Well, no, what bothered me so much, right, is so he's like, you know, but my mother was always there for me. Yeah, but you didn't connect with your mother. You were desperate for a father figure. You didn't connect with your mother and your sisters. You were desperate for your father figure. And that's why you ended up getting molested.
Yeah. And that's what he doesn't want to deal with.
And he won't admit that.
No.
What's going to happen to this girl? The same freak, literally the exact same thing's going to happen to her. And taking her in would have stopped that. But, oh, God, it makes me so angry. And I know it makes you angry, too.
Well, it did when I saw it. I just went, no. And this is why, as I said, this is why the last episode of season 14 was infuriating.
Oh, well, you know what? Don't tell me. I can't wait to get there.
Yeah. You got to get there.
I'm almost done season 10. So then we'll be talking about that surprisingly quickly, the way I'm burning through these episodes.
Finally. Yeah.
Finally. All right. So, yeah. Let's move on to the next episode. But just as we're leaving, I know it sounds like we're being really hard on this show. But I think based on... what this show could have been, what these characters could have been. I think anyone even casually watching this show can see the opportunity that was missed by the show here. It's not just us.
The fans would not have been upset.
The fans would have been fine with that storyline.
Yeah. The fans would have been fine. They would have loved it.
Of course they would have. But, you know... I would like to hear what happened that made them, you know, dump out of that storyline. And the weird part, you know what the worst part would be?
Erica Messer became the showrunner, and she needed her alpha male.
Jesus! Oh!
On the show.
Oh, God. Oh, damn. So brutal. So brutal. But you know what? I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to agree to that. I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm not going to agree to that.
I do not know what else, like, I do not know how to describe it. Yeah. This kind of a thing.
God awful. Yeah. And it is. It's god awful.
It's god awful. If he had not promised her father. No.
They specifically, and it's right, you're right. It is an affirmative choice they're making to have him give that promise.
Yeah.
In that episode.
Yes. And not to follow up on it is just,
it's unforgivable.
Yeah. So I'm a little hard every now and then.
No, I mean, it's fine to be hard on the episode when it's this frustrating. All right. So next up we have
Devil's Night.
Devil's Night. Or as I call it, the easiest case to solve in the history of cases.
When the latest in a series of deadly pre-Halloween arson attacks takes place in Detroit, Michigan, the BAU sets out to profile and track down a serial killer bent on exacting vengeance against the people who destroyed his life.
Okay, who directed this episode?
Charles Haid.
Charles Haid, okay. I'm just curious, because fun fact about this episode. So Devil's Night is a real thing from Detroit. It's a real Detroit, quote-unquote, holiday, where people just wreck stuff the night before Halloween. They just set fires all over the city the night before Halloween. It's called Devil's Night. That's what it is. And what's interesting is, and this is just the one time they've done it so far this season, I thought it was kind of nice. The movie The Crow is set on Devil's Night. It is set the year before when he and his fiance are murdered. It happened on Devil's Night, and he comes back on Devil's Night to kill everybody.
Yeah.
And who's the co-star of the movie The Crow? Ernie Hudson, who plays the arson guy this week. So obviously there was an awareness of the only other representation of Devil's Night in fiction, and Ernie Hudson was specifically cast in this episode as a shout out to The Crow, and that made me really happy. Because The Crow's it's a pretty darn good movie.
Yeah.
Really is. So I just thought that was a nice thing to mention, and way to go, Ernie Hudson. But anyway, let's move on to the actual episode, and we'll talk about the details of the episode in a second, but I just want to point out, here is why I called this the easiest to solve crime in history. Because, you see, many serial killers in this show, when they're mad at somebody, and actually this happens in real life, is they will gradually work up to the person they're mad at by killing other people first, right? And that's, you know, that's what Ed Kemper did. Like, he had severe issues with his mother, and he killed 12 surrogates for his mother before he finally had the guts to kill his mother, right?
Yeah.
That's what Ed Kemper did. And in this situation, in this episode, the strange part is, the guy kills the person he's angriest at first. And then he's like, now I'm going to kill the person I'm least angriest at, second least angriest at. Then I'm going to kill the person I'm least angriest at. Then I'm going to swing back around and kill the person I'm second most angry at. Like, his choice of victims make no sense whatsoever. Because here's what happened. This guy was in a car accident, and he was horrifically burned. He was in a coma for 6 months, and he was horrifically burned, right? And he gets out, and he finds out that his girlfriend has left him. He finds out he has lost his job. He finds out that he has been evicted from his apartment. And he finds out the guy who caused the car accident is just walking around fine. So hit the order in which, obviously, the person he's angriest at is the guy who caused the accident. Second angriest at, the girl.
Girlfriend. Yeah.
The girlfriend. Third angriest at, probably the guy who fired him. Fourth angriest at, the guy, his landlord? Who evicted him when he wasn't paying rent?
Rent, yeah.
Like, so did what landlords frigging do? But anyway, and so what's so crazy about it is, he kills the guy who caused the accident first. Then he's like, now to go after my landlord. What? And the worst part is, how is this not the most easily solved crime they've ever dealt with? Okay, the man was brutally burned to death by someone who hated him. Does anyone have a grudge against this guy? Well, 3 years ago, he caused a car accident in which a man was horrifically burned, and he got away with it. Oh, well, let's just go arrest that guy.
Yeah. Let's just go talk to that guy.
It takes them 30 minutes into the episode before we find out that the guy had been involved in a car accident that left another man horrifically burned. Shouldn't that have been the first thing you find out? Such a dumb episode.
You would think so.
Oh, God. Like, how could you not find out that while working on this case? It's such a dumb episode. There's no excuse for it. Oh, God. Sorry, it really bothers me.
I can tell.
Oh, but it's, I mean, come on. Even by Criminal Minds standards of dumbness, this is bad.
Yeah.
It really is. But
it shouldn't have been allowed to go into the third year. Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, you're just sort of sitting there going, how did this not...
They not catch this guy right away, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, does this... Like, burning to death is an incredibly cruel thing to do. Tying someone to a post and burning them to death. You know, maybe we should look into who might have hated this guy. Oh, he was responsible for a guy being burned half to death. There's a connection there.
Yeah, maybe this is personal.
You know, maybe he's just not randomly burning people for no reason.
As you well know, being profilers, people don't do these things for no reason.
Yeah, like it looks to the outside like it's for no reason because humans normally would never do something like that, so... The human mind wants to interpret an act this horrific as an act of pure madness, but that's not how people are.
But they're profilers. They should know.
So, yeah, they specifically know that's not how it works.
No, I mean, they know this isn't how it works.
Yeah. But, oh, they've got to stretch out the episode. I'm like, did you really, though?
Did you
Could
really?
We have just instead not made this episode?
Or, anyway, I don't know where they would go.
Do you know what my favorite part of the episode was, though? Like, what? By far?
What?
They wanted an... I really feel like, to a certain extent, this episode exists because they wanted a fire for the opening... They wanted an explosion to put in the opening credits of the show to make it look like it's a more exciting show than it actually is.
Ah.
So he blows up the guy's diner, right? He blows up the guy's diner. And hilariously, when they do the long shot of the diner, you can see that, like, it is a fake diner facade that they built just to blow up. Unless, of course, like, there really is a diner between two garages in an alley somewhere.
Who knows? It's Detroit. It's like, there might be. Well,
there might be. Oh, no, but it's interesting because quite obviously they went to this location, right? Right. They went to this location, they built a diner, and they blew it up, and that's the safest place to do it, because, you know, it's just, you know, cinder block garages on either side. There's nothing there's nothing to risk. Like, I get why it happened, but it's kind of funny looking at the set they made.
Well, sometimes they want to blow things up.
That's true. My question is, and this is what they don't get into, right? I really do question why she never mentioned to this guy that he had a son. Like, was he already really violent? He must have been, right?
Well, I'm with you. Like, I'm not sure. Like, why isn't he really, really angry at her?
Yeah. Like, it feels like almost... Well, no, I mean, if you were going in a descending list of who to be angry at, I feel like the girlfriend should have got it next. You know?
Well, the thing is, yeah, I mean, like, it's this kind of... Okay, and you're right. I mean, was he really, really violent first?
He must have been, because that's the only reason you would say, oh my God, this going through this horrific thing is only going to make him worse. I can't let him near my son.
Yeah.
Because only if he was already a really violent guy
you would
think. Make sense
like
for her to keep this a secret.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're saying.
Yeah, no, but even why she didn't keep in contact with him, because he was only in a coma for what, a year?
Yeah, a year.
Like, it seems to me, okay, so she finds out she's pregnant.
She has the kid. Mm-hmm. She names him after his father.
Yeah, so it's not like she hates middle him, name. Supposedly.
Not completely hates him, but...
So, I don't know why she didn't stay in contact with him when he came out of the coma or go and
It's sleep. Not like she went and she got married to somebody else.
No, like it just doesn't...
It doesn't track, right?
Unless, as you say, he'd been a very violent person Guy before.
Already. Yeah, already. If he was already really troubled and violent and beat his girlfriend already.
Yeah.
Before the accident. And she weirdly... What do you call it? Is it crazy to think that him getting set on fire and put in a coma is her escape from this abusive relationship?
Yeah. I mean, that would make sense.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
But the show doesn't even intimate that.
Well, yes, but why would it?
Building psychological realism has never been the show's strong suit.
No. Like, as I said... I think that's what's so annoying at times, too, is that so often there's a friggin' easy fix for the show.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
You know, it's not as if, and it's not as if it's a major issue.
Yeah.
Like what we're talking about in terms of.
The plot. You just have plot. To have, like, no, just throw in a couple of lines about him having been called in, like the cops having been called for. Domestic battery charges against him.
Yeah.
And that there was a restraining order against him from his girlfriend when he had
the accident. Yeah.
When he had the accident. There was a restraining order. Okay, and well, now I understand. You've given me, you've given me a good understanding of who this guy is, why he's so violent, right? Why why he doesn't even know he has a son. Like, you've established why he's willing to start burning people alive. He was already a screwed up guy. And you've explained the fiance, the girlfriend's actions.
Yeah, and the funny thing is...
And it's one line.
Yeah, I know. But the funny thing is when you look at it, right? The conversation, like, you see, it didn't make sense until you start thinking about it. That's half of this, you know. As long as you don't think about the show, it's okay, you know. You get just like, okay, if I don't think about it, maybe I can, you know, let
accept
it go by.
Stuff, yeah.
But what happens is when he's talking to the guy who owns the diner,
the father of his, yeah, that's the father of his girlfriend,
right? And then and he says, you know, she's better off.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, and that would have made...
That's the moment to make that make sense.
That's the moment to make it sense, and it would have made sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It would have made complete sense. If he had been abusing his girlfriend, the rest of, you know, the character... I mean, it still doesn't make sense why he doesn't chase after her right after second, but... Every other action in the episode, all of the other characters, even a bunch of his actions, makes perfect sense if he'd already been, you know, abusing his girlfriend, right?
Yeah, and she had been, and the reason she was pregnant is he'd raped her, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't even have to be that she was pregnant because he raped her. I mean, because the thing is, it's sick, but people stay in these abusive relationships.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing. Once she got out, and, I mean, it was a dead-end thing, and she would have never
gone off. And she didn't have the courage to leave him, and suddenly there's this car accident, and she's like, I'm free! I'm gonna go, I'm gonna hide out, I'm gonna change my last name... I'm going to go and become she was going to medical school. It's like, I'm going to turn my life around. And I've been freed because this guy, at a fluke, I was rescued by this car accident.
Yeah.
Right? Then if that is the plot, every other part of this episode makes sense.
Yeah. But other than that, you're going, okay.
I don't get why anything is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Why is
And that's
so
the thing
insane?
About the show. It's like... You don't understand why anything is happening.
Yeah. We used to.
Not anymore.
Don't you used
but I mean,
to make a lot
look at this.
Sense.
This is two episodes in a row. You add, right?
Yeah.
You add that this guy got molested by the man who lived next door.
Yeah.
Right? Suddenly, everything about that murderous child makes sense.
A lot more.
This episode, you add that this guy was slapping his girlfriend around. Boom. Everything else about the episode
makes
sense.
Yeah, because why would she go into, basically change her name and go into hiding?
Go into hiding. Unless. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why he couldn't find her when he got
out.
That's
why he couldn't. And boom. And it's like, and then you explain why he couldn't find her and he was attacking other people. And then eventually he's like, oh, I'll go after her father, her estranged father.
Yeah.
It occurs to him to do that. Like, so much of this episode makes perfect sense with this rewrite we've given it.
Yeah.
And it's not that complicated a rewrite.
No, if this was a complicated, like, but this is not the first time we've done this.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many times in this show where you don't need a complicated,
no,
it's like somebody just has to friggin' care.
Yeah. Well, no, and the weird
is
part
how
is,
I
it's,
would put it. Somebody
it's needs... a major change to the story, but it's a major change to the story that requires two lines of dialogue. If you put in the two lines of dialogue we're talking about, this episode is essentially fixed. But it's like, you're right, they just don't care. And here's the extent to which they don't care. I think you'll find this funny. I was watching an episode from season 10, and I was telling you the other day about how garbage this episode was. But, because, you know, it's the one where JJ murders someone, so look forward to having us having a lot to say about that in 6 months. But anyway, it's the one where JJ murders someone, and in the episode, there is, like, a perfect microcosm about how little everyone who works on the show cares. So, obviously, someone who, you know how they put, like, driver's licenses and birth certificates and medical records on the screen that Penelope has looked at, and they ask, then they close it, and then they show them on screen for like 1.5 seconds, then they move on to the next thing, right? You're familiar with that trope on the show, how there's always like, they've got some fake documents to pop up.
Yeah.
So obviously someone working at the show, right, said, here's what I'll do to speed things up. I'll make some template bank statements and credit card statements and phone bills. And then whenever, like, you need one for the show, you just type in the company names, you add some data to the various things, and then boom, you got whatever you need for the show, right? So you'll have the template right there. You can use it over and over again. We'll save some time on graphic design.
I haven't.
So when it comes up on screen in the show, they are so lazy that they didn't bother changing the template. So the credit card bill is from credit card services. The phone bill is from telephone company. And the bank records are from bank. They didn't even bother editing the template.
Okay, I'm just in the middle of putting up episode 24.
Okay, so
that's how much I care.
That's how much you care. All right.
I suddenly went, oh, it's Thursday.
No, but it's crazy, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean,
that they don't care at all.
Yeah.
It's not that much extra effort, guys.
Not really.
All right, so yeah, Devil's Night. Verdict on Devil's Night, not good. The verdict on all three of these episodes is that they're all terrible, but in their own way. And two of them were fixable.
Okay.
And the second one, and the third one's entire premise was so, like, grounded in wrong-headed beliefs based on toxic masculinity that it was unsalvageable.
Yeah.
All right. Wow, so I guess the real loser this week is compromising positions. Would you care to tell us what the homework is for next week, Dr. Redmond?
Okay, so, Middleman.
And the one you've just watched and you're excited for me to see.
Oh, yeah, right. Reflection of Desire.
Those words mean nothing to me.
Oh, it's the takeoff on Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. All right. The Robert Knepper Sunset Boulevard episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then Into the Woods.
Okay. All right. So now I know what we're talking about. Yeah. All right. That should be great. So if you're watching along with us, and we hope you are, watch episodes 607 to 609.
Yeah.
And it's going to be our last week before we start talking about all Rachel Nichols all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
So that should be fun. If you have any comments about the episodes, if you have any questions for us, if you have any suggestions for other criminal minds, other profiling related fiction we should check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you're listening to this on a podcast client, you know, your Stitchers, your iTunes, whatever, be sure to give it a rating, because that is how people find the show, by you telling the algorithm what you think about it. So I guess that's that. We will see you back here next week for more Criminal Minds, but until then, au revoir.
And good night.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.